Music from Kris Kristofferson. You probably recognize the voice. Bread for the Body from a new album. Yeah, a new album just put out last year by Kris Kristofferson. It's called Feeling Mortal. And I think the years are starting to tell. Wisdom going a little deeper here with Kris Kristofferson. Really a pretty astounding artist when you think of all he's done. Bread for the Body. It is 11 and a half minutes after the hour now on this Broken Road Radio Monday morning. And as usual, the Monday mornings mean a visit from Dr. Don Clark, who's a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments. And Don joins us from Garden Valley, Texas this morning. Don, happy Monday to you.
Well, happy Monday to you, Jim. It's good to be here.
Well, glad to have you. And the topic this morning, it just is intriguing to me because it seems like we've been here before. I'm like almost deja vu, but kind of going backwards here. Forever, it seems, that science has been in search of the elemental building block of the universe. This goes back to Greek times, and there was this theory proposed that there was something called an atom. I don't know what they really called it at the time. I imagine the word atom has been derived from the Greek. But they thought, surely nothing can be smaller than that, or simpler than that. And fast forward about 3,000 years, and all of a sudden we're looking into atoms and discovering all kinds of things going on in there that we never suspected. It's far more complex than we ever thought. DNA research is a relatively modern thing, but it seems the deeper we get into that, the more complex it gets. And the topic of pseudogenes has surfaced. You brought this to our attention this week, for which I thank you. What is a pseudogene, and how did it get that name?
Well, a pseudogene is a section of DNA. It's a gene. The section of DNA that doesn't appear to code for proteins, and so it was thought that initially this DNA must be junk and it's left over from our evolutionary history, and so it was originally called junk DNA, but now they're finding that some of these genes actually do code. It's just that they're not producing proteins. But in this case of the article that we're talking about, it actually codes for RNA. And so they were, wondering what in the world does this have anything to do with anything? Coding for something else and coding for RNA. I mean, DNA is converted into RNA, and it's then...
I'm afraid of getting a little over people's heads here. Now, when you say coding for, it means functioning to produce proteins that do things, right? I mean, it's the functionality of the DNA.
Right. The DNA has all of the instructions of the cell, basically. Mm-hmm. The DNA is, kind of like the library, if you will, of the cell. So mm-hmm. if the cell needs a new protein or needs a new structural element, there's a signal that's sent to the nucleus of the cell where the DNA is. And then that expresses that particular gene, and it turns on that gene, and then that gene there's a process by which that makes messenger RNA, and then the messenger RNA actually makes the protein. It codes mm-hmm. for the protein. So it's a kind of like a two-step it's actually a multi-step process, it can get a little bit involved, but I think most biology classes these days talk about DNA, talk about RNA, talk about protein synthesis and things of that nature. The structure of DNA we've talked about before was mm-hmm. was discovered or uncovered, if you will, by Watson and Crick. And there's a little book that's been out for years called the Double Helix, which basically talks about their discovery. And they were X-ray, Crick was, but it was an X-ray crystallographer. And they were trying to figure out what the structure of this huge molecule is. They were in competition with Linus Pauling out in California. And they happened to get the right orientation.
They were in competition as to who would first figure this thing out.
Right. Yeah. And it turned out to be Watson and Crick in the UK, as opposed to Linus Pauling out in California. But be that as it may, that started the genetic revolution, really, the molecular revolution. Once we knew the structure of the molecule, then the next task was figuring out how this gigantic molecule eventually codes for amino acids, which are then put together in a specific sequence into proteins, which in itself was fairly complex. And after a number of years, they figured out, well, this three DNA nucleotide sequence codes for like an alanine, for example, or a glycine. These are amino acids in our in our body. And then they figured out the coding. And there were some sequences that didn't code for amino acids, but they were start and stop codes for the genome and for the gene.
What's the difference between the gene and the genome?
Well, the genome is the whole encyclopedia.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And the gene is like if you were to go to an encyclopedia and say, "Well, tell me about this subject." Well, the gene is the subject.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, good analogy. But it seems to me that science, in so many years of studying the creation, nature, would have discovered that there's a certain efficiency to nature, and it doesn't keep waste products around for long. And yet it looked at this extra material and decided it was waste, garbage, junk genes. Doesn't that kind of fly in the face of their experience with nature generally, that there would be just superfluous material?
Well, if you go back go back to Darwin, for example, with evolution, I mean, when he was talking about evolution, the cell, all they could see in the cell was protoplasm, which, just looked like a mixture of soup, and the nucleus of the cell. And because they didn't have very good microscopes back in those days, so they couldn't pick out individual structures. Well, today we know that it's just not a mixture. We know that there is superstructure within the cell. The cell is extremely complex. Nothing happens, by chance, if you will. There are proteins that are specifically designed to carry other proteins from one part of the cell to another part of the cell. And there are feedback upon feedback upon feedback mechanisms within the cell to make the cell do what it's supposed to do and keep doing what it's supposed to do. So today one would say, if you looked at the cell, you would say, my God, this is wonderful, wonderfully complex, and it points to a creator. But we still have folks out there in molecular biology and genetics that say, well, all of this evolved, so we're looking for proof that it evolved. And, look at this. We have all this junk DNA. And the more complex the organism, the more junk DNA we have. Well, the junk DNA, they say, is remnants of old genes that, happened to come along but just didn't work.
Kind of like vestigial DNA, like vestigial organs would be.
Well, exactly, like your tonsils. Remember the tonsils?
They used to think they were vestigial, or your appendix.
Right, exactly. These organs that turn out to be vital to our health in some fashion, like our immune system in those two cases, actually do serve a function, and it's just man who's too ignorant to know what the function is.
Well, I guess they had to conclude something, and they had no evidence, but it seems to me to even name this thing a pseudogene, and now discovering that it has a very important role to play, would be a bit of embarrassment to them.
One would think, and here's it, in this particular one, it's called P10 pseudogene, is very interesting because not only is it not junk DNA, but it's very much involved in regulating the P10 gene. And it does it in multiple ways. Normally, DNA is, and I'm just using this example, is red left to right. And, you know, it doesn't really mean anything, but, you know, it's red in one direction. This particular gene that they found, reading it in one direction gives you a an RNA sequence that affects the P10 gene, but it also can be read in the other direction, which also controls the regulation of that gene. So it's like, you know, who could possibly design a gene that could be read in both directions and, you know, produce even more information?
Obviously, I mean, a dyslexic.
Well, yeah, obviously. But, I mean, you know, if you were to, it would be, the analogy would be, you know, you go ahead and write a chapter in a book. Now, when you write this chapter, the only stipulation is that people should be able to read it both left to right and right to left, and it's got to make sense in both directions.
Be a palindrome. It's kind of a DNA palindrome, then.
Yeah, and, you know, so try to write a whole encyclopedia like that. It would be, you know, for our small minds, if you will, it would be literally impossible. It would be impossible to write a chapter that way.
So are we saying that the DNA would not function without this so-called pseudogene?
In this case, yes. That gene, actually, if the pseudogene, if the P10 pseudogene was malfunctioning, the cell actually goes berserk because the P10 gene actually, you know, kind of regulates, you know, growth within the cell. So if the pseudogene goes haywire, then the cell goes cancerous in this particular case. So God, in his wisdom, created a not just an on-off code, but a whole nother gene that can be read both backwards and forwards that, you know, controls this other very important gene. And in order to keep our cells intact, in order to keep our cells functioning the way they're supposed to function. So this is amazing. You know, I, you know, it's like, you know, how can someone, deny a creator with such creativity. Now, here's another part of these pseudogenes. You know, it was, as I said, they were originally called junk DNA. The junk DNA makes up, or the pseudogenes make up like 50% or more of our genome. So we've got 50% of our DNA that doesn't code for proteins, but apparently codes for something else, and in this case, it seems to be very much involved with the control of the other genes that actually do code for proteins.
So it sounds to me like this discovery, then, that pseudogenes are not really pseudo at all, is like a door opening onto a whole new level of research into DNA and its functionality.
It's a whole level of complexity that wasn't appreciated before.
It's kind of like getting out of the universe and finding a door to another universe.
Yes,
we're just scratching the surface, aren't we?
Oh, we are. We are. It's still you don't have to look very far. I mean, you just look inside your cell, and you've got all of this marvelous, chemistry and biochemistry, going on, and you know, you wonder how in the world this complexity, how can it actually, exist, and where did it come from? I mean, it's got to, you've got to ask these questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what science is still good at, is asking questions. It's sometimes the guesswork that gets us into trouble. We make assumptions about what science has turned up. Science itself makes those assumptions. And as in this case, the junk DNA assumption was totally wrong and led us off in the wrong direction. So in a sense, this is really good, I suppose, because this is interesting stuff. But still, there's that the recognition that there's a creative designer behind this. That statement has yet to be made forthrightly by science as a whole. There's still division, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do have, folks that are, looking at these things and looking at the complexity of life, for example, and coming to the conclusion that there's got to be a designer. Now, a lot of them haven't stepped over and said, it's a creator God who is the designer. I don't know why they wouldn't say that, but they just kind of say, well, I don't know who designed this, and they leave it at that. But there's still a lot of people in science that are atheists. And the things that they are working on, point them to God. I mean, just like, the scripture says, the heavens declare the glory of God. Excuse me. And anything that we look at, natural, for example, whether it's, biology, anything in biology, if we start, looking and seeing how it was put together, mm-hmm. anything in the universe, I mean, why the universe is so tuned the way it is, and it can lead, to only one conclusion, that there is a designer. So, these folks that are out there that are saying, well, everything points to that there isn't a God is very much deceived. And, deceived by our enemy. And they've got their eyes blinded by the enemy. And they can't come to the realization that there is a creator God. And he is... not only created everything, but he is very much intimately, involved with our lives.
You know, the finding or the conclusion that there is no God seems to be intuitively just dead wrong. And I'm trying not to speak from a biased position here. Just looking at facts. If we remember your algebra classes from junior high school, probably. You solved for an unknown. You gave it a name. It was X. And you solve for the unknown. You don't make it disappear. You don't pretend it doesn't exist. You solve for it. So, what if these atheists would just give God the X and solve for it rather than saying, well, there's no X?
Put themselves in a box, and are presupposing, well, science, we can't say anything about, mm-hmm. Anything about God, because we've got to stay within this materialistic box. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that if you combine yourself to that box and you can't go outside the space-time continuum to say that there is somebody who, created all things, then you've got to, you can't explain these things.
Well, this is the same mistake as the early evolutionists made when they could not see. They didn't have the tools. They didn't have microscopes that were good enough to see inside the cell, to see what was in the protoplasm, the matter around the nucleus. It's like they can't see spiritual things because they don't have spiritual tools.
And they don't have spiritual eyes. Now, when I first became a Christian, it was like the scales literally fell off my eyes, because I did tell the evolutionary story, and I had it down down pat, if you will. Mm-hmm. But when I became a Christian, the scales literally, not literally fell off my eyes, but it was like a whole door was opened, And now Genesis, especially the first part of Genesis, made a lot of sense. And when you know, when I started reading it, I said, this is the only way it could have possibly happened. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one would say, well, okay, you had to have faith in order to, you know, believe that way. And of course, you know, faith mm-hmm. is involved in everything. Even an atheist has faith. An atheist has faith in his, you know, faith that there is no God. And so he's got to explain everything just from the world that he sees around him.
Well, but, your analogy of the scales falling off off your eyes reminds me of the C.S. Lewis quote, and I can't give it to you verbatim, but he was asked if he'd seen the sunrise, and he said how does he know the sun has risen? Well, he's seen its light, but he's also seen everything else by its light. So it's a paradigm shift that has to happen here. It's not only acknowledging the sun has risen, but observing what happens now that the sun has risen and what has changed in that, and distinguishing between the two, the old and the new. You do a great job of explaining complex things to us, and we're blessed. Thank you for that. The pseudogene, it works. It's not junk DNA. And those of you interested in tracking down the article, we'll have a link to it as we post our conversation this morning on the BrokenRoadRadio.com page under Audio Archives Podcast. You can listen to it anytime. Don, you've been with us for just about 2 years now. It's been about that long.
It's hard to imagine, but
yeah, accumulated quite a few podcasts on various topics. Don and we normally talk about science versus faith and creation versus evolution and scientific things. And if you're interested, you can download those podcasts, listen to them at your convenience, or listen right there on the website at BrokenRoadRadio.com. You'll also find a link there to CreationMoments.com. Don, of course, a board member at Creation Moments. This particular article comes from the Institute of Creation Research. And it's an article by Dr. Jeffrey Tompkins called Bewildering Pseudogene Functions Both Forwards and Backwards. And I think you'll find it interesting. And it's not a deep, heavy kind of scientific analysis here. It's something that you'll be able to read and absorb quite easily. Don, how are things in Garden Valley this morning? Don is growing grapes. He's becoming a, what's the word again? Vigneron. There you go.
Yes. Well, it's a lot of work to become a vineyard manager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exploring new fields. Yeah,
especially down south where the vines grow so rapidly, and trying to keep them in order is a tremendous job. Yeah, I mean, it's between managing the grapes and spraying the grapes and managing the weeds and cutting the grass.
Trimming and pruning. There's a good thing that you've got the New Testament with you and all that good vigneron advice that you find right there.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And if you don't prune the vines, then they don't bear much fruit. And, you know, if you don't care for them, then they don't bear much fruit, or the fruit rots and, you know, drops off. And so there's all kinds of analogies, and we'll eventually do you know, Bible studies on on that with hands-on practical experience. So that's one of the goals of the
vineyard. That would be interesting. Don, we'll look forward to next week with you. Monday, I think we'll have a full staff here for you, so we'll look forward to that. And again, thank you for joining us this morning and telling us about the pseudogene. Interesting stuff.
Don, you're quite welcome. It's good. It was good to be with you this morning as well.
Don, take care. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.